You're listening to C2Y Podcast. We bring you discussions on child and youth care that feature conversations with young people, parents, and professionals about the youth social service system. Introducing your host, Wolfgang Vachon.
Welcome to C2Y Podcast Discussions on Child and Youth Care. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. In August, I posted the links to several videos related to young people and care of the state. One of the videos I posted was a presentation by John Paul Fitzpatrick on his research about youth in home supervision. There's been an ongoing debate for many years regarding whether it is best to have young people live in care or stay at home. In North America, the common practice is to have people live at home if at all possible. In April of 2013, I spoke with Dr. Tunil Islam about residential care in Bangladesh. In Bangladesh, parents actively and willingly put their children into residential care, and by many it's seen as preferable to living at home. Today, John Paul Fitzpatrick will discuss state care in the context of Scotland. Mr. Fitzpatrick is the Knowledge Exchange Lead of the Centre for Excellence for Looked After Children and is an Associate Dean at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland. Welcome, John Paul.
Hello, Wolfgang. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Thank you very much for joining us from far, far away. So let me ask you, does Scotland have the same debate regarding young people living at home or in residential care?
These are very lively debates, and it's beginning from what you were saying there in the introduction to sound like a bit of a global phenomenon. To put it into context, Wolfgang, we've got a population of young people in care, which is around 16,000 out of a total population of 5 million. And out of all of them, in terms of being in the care of the state, we have around a small group of about 5,000 of them, so just under a quarter, which are looked after at home. So they still reside in the parental home, but they have state support in terms of social work support and are recognised as requiring additional support. So it's a very lively and topical debate, particularly because it's often linked, unfortunately, to finances and some forms of care being perhaps economically being perceived as being cheaper options, and in times of austerity, which we have real pressure here in Scotland, as indeed across, I'm sure these are similar issues in terms of North America, but real issues of pressure on budgets for children's services. So yeah, very topical, very lively debate just now around group living versus is it better to intervene or not to intervene, and what type of support is the most effective support.
And are you seeing these debates reduced to a fiscal discussion, or are there larger issues around efficaciousness?
Yeah, there's huge complex issues when you start to pay it all back. So, for example, the Centre for Excellence for Looked After Children in Scotland, CELSIS, the organisation that I work for, is primarily funded by Scottish Government to look at best practice around supporting vulnerable children, young people in care, those that are in foster care or looked after at home or indeed in through care. And we are investing a lot of our time and effort to work with authorities, so they are the providers of care, to look at the outcomes and their gathering of evidence of impact of the effectiveness of care. And that really involves a whole series of remodeling services and actually trying to put young people's best interests at heart, at the making sure that the voice of the child is heard, making sure that young people have appropriate care plans and are fully aware of the contents of their own care plan and have had meaningful involvement in the decisions affecting their care. So these are all the top drivers for work with children and young people just now in Scotland. And some of that is a knee-jerk response to having to do more with less resource, Wolfgang.
Right. Let's take those one at a time. So you talk about best practices for supporting people in care and looking at the outcomes of effectiveness of care. What are the outcomes you're seeing, generally speaking, about the effectiveness of young people in care, whether it be at home or in residential?
Well, one of the reasons I elected to do a PhD, which in itself is an exercise in insanity and not to be recommended, was my perceiving of an ethical injustice taking place across the country with regards to young people in care and their educational attainment. In Scotland, and I believe it's quite similar to Ontario, young people in care are least likely to go on to any form of higher education. They are least likely to come out of school with a baseline level of qualifications. They're least likely to go on to university. And for me, why should that be an acceptable situation in 2014? So that's what drove me to actually look at educational attainment and young people in care. So their outcomes are still just absolutely not good enough. I think there's I think it's an ethical injustice, that's how I describe it, taking place that absolutely urgently needs redress.
And it just, why is that? I mean, one of the other videos I posted was specifically around supporting youth in care and post-secondary education. Why are we seeing so few people who are in the care of the state, you know, graduating? In North America, we call it high school, going into post-secondary or tertiary education.
Well, I think there's so many complex reasons for that, which in Scotland we have tried to tackle, in different ways. So, for example, the residential workforce, so those that are working with children and young people in kind of group living situations, up until fairly recently, did not require to have a high level of qualification themselves. So there's been a big campaign and big changes over the last 5-6 years in Scotland to change that. And the theoretical thinking behind that is, if they have a good level of qualification, a higher level of qualification, they are more likely to encourage and value education themselves, and these values will be transmitted to the young people and children that they're working for. And actually their confidence in dealing with things like homework and encouraging support around education and engaging with education with confidence will actually translate into improved outcomes and focus on education. But the other challenge in all of this, and this I'm sure is the same the world over, is that different services don't prioritise education the same way necessarily. So, obviously, education teachers will prioritise education, but may not understand the particular issues that children in care have in terms of trauma, in terms of what's going on in their lives, in terms of the reasons for that are driving behaviours. Social workers might understand the behaviours, but may not have the time to prioritise education. Parents are quite often, of young people in care, whilst they're still involved, may not be in a position to adequately support children and young people and have had perhaps negative experiences in terms of their own education. And you've got all these different actors in the system, and none of them necessarily are placing education in the right way for young people, vulnerable children and young people to engage with. And actually, I suppose it's a byproduct of the state care systems being designed to cater to the needs of the mass or the many, rather than the individual tailored needs of young people who don't deal well with some of the routines and structures that we place upon them. So there's a huge range of different series of factors competing and colliding to make sure that young people don't thrive in this situation.
Let's take a step back for a moment. You know, I know many young people who have not succeeded in education or haven't finished education, or the educational system wasn't particularly, didn't work for them. Mm. And some of these people have become, you know, quite successful in life in a variety of metrics, not necessarily economically, but, you know, some economically, some otherwise. Is there any empirical research or data that shows the education needs to be prioritized for youth in care, that the outcomes for youth in care who have an education versus those who leave school for whatever reasons, that the outcomes are better for those who stay in school?
Yes, there is empirical evidence in terms of success. But that's an interesting question, actually, that you pose there, because who determines what is success? Mm-hmm. Is success driven by paper qualifications? Is it driven success for many of the young people I suspect that you've worked with, Wolfgang, and that I have in the past? Is actually a young person being able to hold it together in a group work situation for the first time, or being able to get out of bed 2 days in a row to be able to hold down a work placement, you know? So there are different measures of success. Many, you could argue, I suppose, that many of the measures and the outcomes we talk about are driven by the kind of capitalist system in terms of their readiness for the workforce and in terms of the labour market. And of course, at CYC, we are interested in young people being able to thrive and achieve their full potential. So I think that when you talk about the success factors of some of the young people who have had bad experiences or negative experiences or overcome adversity, what we're talking about is resilience and individual resilience. And what I think we need to get better at professionally is creating the circumstances for resilience for young people to become more resilient, for young people to use trusted adults to leverage their social capital. And that's been an interest of mine in terms of my thesis. So in terms of the role that child and youth care workers and other professions have to help young people leverage resources and access power, challenge power, access resources at the right time when they need to have that trusting relationship, and to have meaningful relationships with adults and with peers to enable young people's skills to develop, their resilience and confidence to develop. Because quite often young people have had difficult experiences where, through one reason or another, they've been let down by adults and peers, and trust, the attachment, their ability to bond and to relate with others is difficult. And I think we need to just get better at creating the conditions of trust and quality relationships. So a quality of relationship in terms of time and agencies, of not seeing young people as one of a huge number of caseloads, but getting back to meaningful quality relationships with those that we work with. I think that's my big plea for where we are in 2014. And what's potentially most at threat is time. There are so many things that are designed to take away from meaningful time with children and young people, be it the bureaucracy of systems, be it report writing, be it less time, less budget, more caseloads. But we need to resist these trends and actually make the case as a profession to say good youth work needs time invested with children and young people to build those connections, to build that trust, to enable them to thrive and to truly understand what young people's needs and aspirations are.
Indeed, I agree wholeheartedly. About a week, just over a week ago, I was working with a group of young folks, and we were talking about experiences that they had, and we were using theater and improvisation to explore some of those experiences that they had. And I was portraying a youth worker who was working on the computer, and then the young person came into the room and I got off the computer. And to a person, every single one of them remarked about how amazing it was that I prioritized talking to them over the paperwork. And so for so many young people, their experience seems to be with professionals, with workers, is they are constantly told, hold on, 5 minutes, just give me, I just need to do this, I just need to do this. And that the paperwork and the structures around that from the young person's perspective, whether or not this is accurate from the young person's perspective, which I think we always need to hold as a priority perspective.
Absolutely.
That is what that's the types of relationships they're seeing with professional care providers.
And that echoes my experience in terms of having worked in, you know, I've worked 15 years in professional practice, and that has been my experience as well. And isn't it sad when young people are so aware of the bureaucracy and the professional shorthand jargon that social workers and other professions use within the presence of young people, rather than them being able to be young people themselves and to have those meaningful quality relationships? I don't think it's a big ask in terms of a basic entitlement when working with children and young people, that we make the time, that we have the state of mind to make ourselves present, to be fully engaged with those that we're working with, and to prioritise what's in front of us at the time in terms of need, and start listening, properly listening to what young people are telling us through their verbals, their non-verbals, the whole package of measures that young people present with. And I find it frightening what you're saying. Anyway, that was a mini rant, Wolfgang. I'm sorry for that.
That's okay. This is a forum for mini rants and major rants as well. This, you know, what we're discussing now comes back to what you identify as the second purpose of CELSIS, the Center for Excellence for Looked After Children, that being remodeling services. And then the third point you mentioned, which was the voice of children being heard. I know you've done a lot of work around youth participation. What might that look like in a real and a tangible way when it comes to remodeling services? How might a youth perspective or voice be part of that discussion?
Well, there are, in Scotland, as indeed across the world, there are pockets of amazing practice where you see young people genuinely empowered to make decisions. And you can often see that reflected in employment practice, where young people are making up interview panels, where young people are actually involved in policy making and decision making. And then the other end of that spectrum is, and you may have experienced this or witnessed this yourself, is where it's almost like young people are living in the bottom of some sort of spontaneous filing cabinet and are pulled out every so often to perform like dancing monkeys because there's an inspection or a visit, or, you know, we want to tokenistically involve the young people in a particular presentation. That drives me nuts. And I have seen much of that through professional practice. So I think it's about getting the policy context right in an organisation that works with young people, to value young people and to put young people at the heart of decision making where it's appropriate, and to go the extra mile to try and seek the views of children and young people and not resort to the same old lazy practices that we do. So we should be using drama, we should be using music, we should be using theatre, we should be using a whole range of different measures to engage with young people, to have their voices heard, but heard meaningfully, and not just heard, but acted upon. So how often are young people consulted to death, but never find out the impact of what their voice being heard actually made in terms of tangible change, either for themselves or for other young people? We often don't get back to young people to say, look, 2 years ago we spoke, I asked you this, I want you to know this is what has changed as a result of your input. We don't do it. So young people
are... Why don't we do it?
There's quite often resource implication in terms of it costs money and time, or we forget, or the agenda moves on, or stress, or workloads, or pressure on individual workers, or just the fact that it's not the part of the norm. The normal rhythm of a group home, the normal rhythm of a youth work agency. We don't just, as a matter of course, have it as part of the culture and the fabric of being. And that needs to change. We need to think about how we meaningfully engage, consult, and work with young people to have their voices heard and acted upon. If you know, we need to get back to Article 12 in terms of the rights of the child to make sure that, that young people's views are sought in the matters that impact on their lives. And I think also, in some respects, technology and other factors have moved on at a faster pace than workers' abilities to engage. So if it's Twitter, if it's social media, whatever the mechanism is, we need to be engaging with young people using on a variety of different levels, using every platform and every mechanism and channel that we can to keep that dialogue and conversation going with them. Because otherwise we're going to be left behind. And that doesn't bear thinking about.
Do you see any examples from Youth in Care in Scotland in particular, where youth are brought into the process and have had an impact on their care?
Yeah, definitely. There's an agency in Scotland which called Who Cares Scotland, which is an advocacy organisation for children and young people in primarily in residential care, although they have an expanded remit now, looking across the continuum of care. And they've practised what they've preached, and they have employed young people as members of the workforce, so given them, participated in a government training scheme to secure some funds and create an apprenticeship for them where they're being employed as apprentice youth workers. And as part of their employment program, recognising that young people in care don't do so well educationally, they're being supported through qualifications at the same time for their youth involvement. And I think that's absolutely brilliant modelling, using young people to work with other young people, but also practising what they preach in terms of making sure that young people achieve qualifications and tangible outcomes.
What's the name of the organisation again?
It's Who Cares Scotland. And I will be able to give you a link at the end of this, Wolfgang, that you'll be able to post up on the site for listeners that are interested and want to click through to the organisation. But it's just brilliant practice of meaningful young people's involvement. And I think there are many examples like that where it's fairly simple steps. It might be a change of policy. It might be employing young people. If you're going to employ young people to work as mentors or in a supported role, you just need to think through some of the boundary stuff, the confidentiality issues, the making sure that young people have a positive, supported experience. And that's harder, actually, sometimes, even in youth work organisations, because we can become so fraught and frightened of the because we know of the issues. Sometimes that actually can act as an inhibitor and paralyze us into not doing it. But we need to do that type of work more. We need to pro-socially role model what we're doing here with children and young people and actually mentor them and employ them and do different creative things with them to have them involved. And Who Cares is one such example that I thoroughly commend to people.
That's great to hear. In your research, you talked about the ethical implications of the lack of educational support and educational success with young people in care, but that certainly wasn't the only focus of your research. What have you found about the outcomes of young people in care, whether it be home supervision or outside of and into residential care?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'm in the kind of process of writing up the findings just now. But some of the early findings are, and this one, none of my findings are rocket science, but the one that I found that jumped out at me, and I thought, why is this still happening? But young people constantly told me that they were fed up with the lack of continuity of professionals in their lives who understood their values, their views, and their needs. And they were sick of constantly having to retell their same story to change of social worker, to change of teacher, to change of youth mentor. There was no continuity or very little continuity in the professionals that were working with them around their needs in their lives. Now, you know what it's like when having to share really sensitive information about yourself. So for young people who are particularly vulnerable, having to constantly regurgitate their stories, it's just not acceptable. It's quite easily avoidable in terms of better information sharing between professionals, appropriate information sharing. Young people were telling me many occasions where they felt that their respect or right to confidentiality had been circumvented, and oversharing of information. The other thing, actually,
how do we balance that? So on the one hand, I'm hearing you say people don't want to tell their story over and over and over again. And on the other hand, I hear people, you know, are perceiving that the system, if we can use such broad terms, you know, disclosing personal information with themselves in an effort, as I understand it, to reduce the necessity of them repeating their stories. How do we balance those two factors?
Yeah, and I don't think we'll ever achieve that balance where young people, by very nature of the circumstances that young people find themselves in, will always feel that that is right. But I think there are systemic pressures in terms of resourcing, in terms of the systems and processes and procedures for sharing information, particularly between different professional groupings. So we have the number of different professions all working and still in artificial bunkers or silos, often for the same government agency, but not sharing their information appropriately, or don't have the systems, or indeed are working under such horrific pressures and caseloads that there's a lot of sickness and absence, etc., which is requiring backfill of temporary staff, which means that another person is then parachuted in to start engaging with a young person to pick up the pieces. And all of that serves to break down the fabric of trust with young people. So it's difficult because what we're dealing with economics, we're dealing with complex systems and interrelated systems, but these systems need to better work together. We need to make better use of a practical level of IT and recording, and also think there's some basic skills development still needed with the workforce in terms of working with children and young people, in terms of active listening skills and making sure that young people feel valued and safe and supported. And quite often some of that basic communication still not happening with young people.
That's very, very sad to hear. What else did you find in your research as you disseminate the findings?
Yeah, I think that there's still a missed trick in terms of better involving parents and carers to encourage participation, young people's participation in programs, whatever those programs are. And I think quite often we focus all of our effort and attention on the young people themselves and don't do in taking cognizance of their whole circumstance. And quite often, and I understand there are often complex factors why we don't engage with parents and carers, but we need to try and get better at doing it. I think there are ways that of doing it. For example, schools and teachers quite often don't engage, and this is what one of the findings of the study was, that the parents were quite often scared to engage with school, and that was actually being driven by their own anxiety around their educational levels, their own negative experience of education. So what teachers were interpreting as parents not showing any interest in their education was actually being driven by behaviours that the parents were actually scared to engage with education. So there's some stuff around stigma and education there. Mm-hmm. But I think the critical finding of the study was young people who are in care, and my kind of sample of being looked after at home, absolutely value informal coaching and mentoring and support mechanisms. Half my sample were being mentored. The other half weren't. Those that were...
Was that by design?
Yeah, well, no. I mean, yes, Wolfgang, of course, clearly the research had this. It was actually a complete accident, a complete fluke. But it turned out that half the young people were participating in a scheme whereby they had a coach who actually participated with them in their alternative educational programs, and they absolutely thrived. So I spent a lot of time delving into that. And it was because they were a neutral party, they were youth work trained, so they weren't a teacher, they weren't a social worker, they had the relational skills, they had the engagement skills, they acted basically as a broker, holding that young person together through the course of their school day. They were with them from 9:30 in the morning to the end of their school day, sitting in their classes, with them at lunch breaks, one worker working with about 9 young people. And I actually had the pleasure to witness some of this engagement when I was conducting the fieldwork interviews. And you could see the relationship. You could see the respect that the young people had for the worker, and that it felt like a different relationship. And actually, if it hadn't been for, this is an interesting thing about gatekeepers, so if anybody out there is wanting to engage with a piece of action research or you know, conduct something, think about the role of gatekeepers and how you're going to access the young people. Because once the young people saw me speaking to the coach, they were much more likely, obviously, to come over and speak to me once that initial introduction had been kind of made. And it's just about that respect and where young people are at in terms of relationships. So yeah, coaching absolutely makes a difference. We need to invest more in coaching and mentoring schemes, and actually do it quicker. So for a lot of the young people in my study that I spoke to, it went particularly wrong for them in times of transition between junior school and secondary school, or secondary school and moving on to employment. That's when, despite the plethora of other factors in their lives, that's when it went particularly wrong for them. If we can invest in coaching and mentoring and support programs when young people are experiencing or transition or about to experience transition, we would be able to help young people secure their tenancies, their group living experience, their educational experience. We must invest more in youth work and informal coaching. That is probably the crux of what I uncovered. And again, that's not rocket science, but it was very affirming for me. I am a youth work practitioner to trade. It was just, I had forgotten, really, I suppose, having been away in terms of going to get into academia, just what powerful transformative relationships take place when there's good relational people in their lives who have appropriate levels of training in youth engagement skills and techniques, Wolfgang. So I found that for me was probably one of the biggest things.
I think that's such a beautiful way to end this conversation, that relationship, meaningful, engaged relationship with young people, which is designed to support them, is the most effective way to work with young people. You're right, this is not new information, but every time a new piece of research comes out and reaffirms that what we've known from our years and years and years of practice, the stronger the ability to make the argument to those funding bodies that say it's too expensive to have one-on-one relationships, and the easier it is to make the change. So I want to thank you for doing that research, Jean-Paul, and of course I want to thank you for taking the time today. I know you just got off a very, very long flight, so I really appreciate you taking the time to have our conversation today.
My pleasure, Wolfgang. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I would like to ask all of you once again to share this podcast with others. Put it on your Facebook, tweet it, and disseminate. The more people that are part of these conversations, ultimately, the more we will be able to make sure there's impacting change.
This concludes this month's episode of C2Y Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher and visit us at c2ipodcast.org.